Greetings once again to you, my fellow man. You may have heard the news, but stand by now for the Worldview. That's right, it is the Weekly Worldview, and I'm your humble host, Doug McBurney. Welcome to the broadcast that is the pulse of conservative talk on the radio. It's a show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do take the events of the week and focus them through the lens of original thought. We go worldwide to a worldwide audience, unconstrained by the traditional bounds of the broadcast media. Welcome aboard, and what a week it's been. What a week. I don't know if I am cut out to work 50 hours a week in an office. I just don't know if I can do it. It's no fun, ladies and gentlemen. It is certainly no fun. Having one's life controlled by the need for money, it's just a drag. But I suppose in the end, there is a positive. A light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak. And so I will continue to work in order to put food on the table for my wife and my beautiful little daughters. And I will continue to be here for you, reporting the news of the week in a way that is comprehensible for the modern right-wing Christian radical conservative. So fear not, I shall soldier on. Let's start this week in the international file as we in this story. Dateline Berlin from the Reuters Newswire. Fans attending one of the world's biggest heavy metal festivals in Germany were asked this past week to avoid hugging, kissing on the cheek, and shaking hands, lest they spread the H1N1 influenza swine flu virus. That's right. You heard it here first. The Wacken Open Air Rocken Festival is going on there in Germany. And on the website, the Health Ministry of Germany's Northern Schleswig-Holstein region optimistically advised revelers to restrain from any such sociable behavior so as to minimize the infection risk at the Wacken Open Air Rock and Roll Festival, which ended over this past weekend. Yeah, I went to the website for the Wacken Festival. They're rocking at Wacken, right? Anyway, there were like 40 bands. Most of them residing in the Where Are They Now file, in the annals of rock history. There were a few I recognized. Anthrax. We all remember Anthrax, right? Not really. D.A.D. Yeah, we all remember D.A.D., right? The big hits. And Saxon. Now, you got to remember Saxon. These are all 80s alleged talent. And anyway, they're doing the big rock festival there in Germany. And, you know, the governing officials there, their heart's in the right place. They want to prevent the transmission of the swine flu virus. So they advise the rockers out at the Wacken Festival to avoid hugging, kissing on the cheek, and shaking hands lest they spread the swine flu. You know, my advice is, you know, if you're at a heavy metal festival, dressed in leather with the leather metal studs and the dog collars and that whole thing and the tattoos and the face piercing. Swine flu is probably the least of the communicable diseases that you have to worry about festering just under the surface there at the Wacken Festival. And how about warning young people to avoid heavy metal festivals to avoid disease? I mean, forget the H1N1 flu virus, for crying out loud. Can you imagine what goes on at a German heavy metal festival? Well, we'll not even get into that. It's not fit for public consumption, ladies and gentlemen. Continuing on in the international file, as the entire world topples and teeters, spinning on toward ultimate disaster, Dateline Istanbul, again from our good friends and communists at the Reuters Wire, a restaurant owner in southwest Turkey was shot dead after he tried to prevent his customers from smoking in order to comply with a new ban on the use of tobacco indoors. there in Turkey. A fight broke out, apparently, after Hadir Kayaracit ordered a group of customers to extinguish their cigarettes when they began smoking at his restaurant in the town of Surahanahanahari. Few too many vowels in that word. I can't read that. One of the customers, who was asked to extinguish his cigarette, shot the restaurant owner 4 times after the restaurant owner had taken away the group's cigarettes. Turkey's government, back on July 19th, you'll all remember, introduced a nationwide ban on indoor smoking, including bars and restaurants, despite the fact that half of Turks between the ages of 15 and 50 smoke. It's one of the highest smoking rates in the world. Surahanli mayor, the mayor of Surahanli, Veli Yalcin, told the newspaper, "I'm deeply saddened that the first smoking ban murder occurred in our town." As if he was anticipating someone was going to get killed. I don't know what. I'm deeply saddened that the first smoking ban murder occurred in our town. They either shouldn't have outlawed smoking, or they should have outlawed alcohol along with smoking. Now, I don't know about that, Mr. Veli Yalcin, the mayor there. I mean, you've already got one poor guy shot dead over smoking. Imagine what would happen if they banned alcohol as well, for crying out loud. Anyway, you know, when people are slaves of the flesh, I mean, if you can't just exercise a modicum of self-control and refrain from smoking for just a few minutes, maybe an hour or two, you know, maybe you need to sit down and reevaluate what your priorities are in life. But, you know, a slave to the flesh in a pagan culture, maybe smoking's the only thing these slobs have going for them, and when you take it away from them, well, they tend to freak out, obviously. All right. Now, some more from the international file. It's a thick one this week. We're going to get to some politics later, and some justice, and some injustice. Plenty of injustice out there. Speaking of which, let's talk about this tale from the international file. From the Associated Press, Lisbon, Portugal, a fugitive murderer spent 16 years hiding in caves around his home village in northern Portugal before he was recaptured. This past week, yes, Manuel Cruz, 54-year-old convicted murderer, had a deep tan and a long beard when he was arrested in the forested hills where he once had been a shepherd, interestingly enough. The police officials who arrested Cruz said that, quote, "he wasn't very strong, but he wasn't in very bad shape," unquote. 11 officers arrested him in what police had dubbed Operation Cro-Magnon. Yeah, Operation Cro-Magnon. You're all familiar with Cro-Magnon Man. That's a reference to a popular myth that there once were ape-like men with very thick foreheads and eyebrows and very dingy beards, bad dental work, all of that. You've heard that old myth, right, about Cro-Magnon Man? Anyway, I just thought it was funny that they named the operation Operation Cro-Magnon, after a popular evolutionary myth, Cro-Magnon Man. Now, Mr. Cruz, the convicted murderer, was spending a 10-year sentence for murder when he fled during a weekend furlough in the village. So he's in prison serving time for murder. He gets a weekend furlough, which means he left the prison and went home for the weekend. And for some reason, he decided never to return to the prison. Very strange. European justice is quite odd, don't you think? I mean, here in America, we allow murderers to live, and we profane God in that way. But we don't generally give them weekend furloughs, although we are moving closer and closer toward our European brethren in everything we do. And so, before too long, not only will we profane God by not executing murderers, but we'll give them weekend passes, and maybe even a little spending money. Well, anyway, this particular murderer was convicted after an argument over goats with a local woman. When he pushed her, she hit her head on the ground and later died. And he was convicted of murder appropriately. It's like this fellow was a vagabond on the earth. He escaped from prison and lived in caves with the animals dwelling outside. a vagabond on the earth, east of Eden, so to speak. To make reference to another story that's not a myth, and that would be the story of Cain and Abel, if you're all familiar. So anyway, there we have it. The state of justice in Portugal, well, not what it used to be. Now let's, do I want to do this from the we'll talk about a little bit from the United Nations, even though it's really an exercise in futility. It can be somewhat entertaining sometimes. I'm not sure this story will achieve that, but I'm willing to take a try. Dateline the United Nations from the Associated Press. I love how they do a dateline at the United Nations as if it's a country. Dateline the United Nations. The U.S. diplomat pressing for implementation of U.N. sanctions intended to derail North Korea's rogue nuclear weapons program said this past week that he was off to an unprecedented start in getting governments to enforce the punishing new measures against North Korea. The Security Council, you remember, imposed tough new sanctions on North Korea back in June, strengthening an arms embargo and authorizing ship searches on the high seas to try to rein in its nuclear program after Pyongyang's second nuclear test back in May. Now, you remember that we followed a ship around for a little while, and apparently it turned around and headed home. They weren't quite ready for a confrontation. And I'm sort of thankful because I'm not sure we were quite ready for a confrontation with that particular boat. Anyway, who is this fellow who the story is about? A gentleman named Goldberg. Philip Goldberg. He's with the Security Council Committee monitoring the implementation of sanctions against North Korea. He says he's got a strong commitment from China and the U.S. and all 192 U.N. member states to enforce these unprecedented punishment measures against the madmen in North Korea. He says, quote, "It is certainly our intention to work with all member states, but especially those that can bring results in terms of implementation. And I do believe that there have been some results," he said without elaborating. Yeah. He didn't want to elaborate because elaborating would have made obvious the fact that that the king has no clothes, that the sanctions are relatively meaningless in a closed slave society, cult of personality kingdom like North Korea. The king has no clothes? I should have said the queen has no clothes. Isn't Hillary Clinton the Secretary of State at this point? Yeah. Okay, well, I'm sorry to have implied a visual like that. Okay, let's just move on. I don't want to go any further there. Dateline Bhubaneswar, India, from the Reuters Wire. A stray snake brought Parliament to a standstill for several hours this past week in India's Orissa state. The Speaker of the Assembly in the state capital of Bhubaneswar adjourned the House as security personnel, wildlife officials, and a member of a local snake helpline unsuccessfully searched for the creature with the help of a sniffer dog. It was a snake, I said. Oh, they thought it was a snake, but they couldn't find him. They had a sniffer dog. They even had a fellow there from a local snake helpline. Now, how many of us even thought that there was a snake helpline in India? And my question is it to help the snake, or is it to help the people? I mean, it's a snake helpline. I guess they have a lot of problems with snakes there in India. But in this particular case, it was later determined that the intruder was actually Hillary Rodham Clinton visiting on behalf of the U.S. State Department. And the sniffer dog has not yet recovered. She's got the jack. 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 She's got It's the Weekly Worldview, and I'm your host, Doug McBurney. That poor dog didn't know what hit him. Never even saw that one coming. He never dealt with a low-down, dirty animal. Like Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton. Anyway, let's continue on. Into the international file. Not to be too ridiculing of global politics, or politicians in general, or domestic politics, or domestic politicians. Let's go to London. From the Reuters Wire, a British teenager who phoned the White House in the United States and claimed as part of a drunken prank that there was a bomb in the center of New York has escaped a jail sentence. That's right, Thomas Hutchinson, a 19-year-old drunken English punk from Sheffield, North England, made a giggling call to the White House switchboard after drinking with his friends at a barbecue last year and claimed that there was a bomb in Madison Square Garden. You may or may not remember this story. I can assure you the folks who got the call there in New York, they certainly do remember that story. The folks who got the call there at the White House, they remember the story. Prosecutor Stephen Acaster said that there was great concern when the call was first received, but it was soon realized it was a hoax, and Madison Square Garden was never actually evacuated. There in Sheffield, England, the magistrate's court this past week, our drunken English fellow, Tom Hutchinson, was given a 6-month jail sentence suspended for 18 months and ordered to carry out 250 hours of unpaid work. Okay, this guy could be working at the same place I am. 250 hours of unpaid work. I don't know that it would teach him much of a lesson, but I'm not sure that this is teaching him much of a lesson at all. Let's see, what did the judge have to say? The judge, one Tony Brown, he said, quote, 1 minute's thoughtlessness by you, young lad, 1 moment of madness, 1 drunken prank, all had very serious consequences. Unquote. So that's what the judge said to the young boy. And my question to the judge would be, what serious consequences? Seriously, I mean, you've just taught this punk that your entire justice system there in the north of England is pretty much a joke. And believe me, young men, take those lessons to heart. I can assure you, you know, when I was quite a bit younger, back in my very, very early 20s, I had just gotten out of the service, and I was living out in California, and I got myself into a bit of trouble. And I had to go face the court, and I had a court-appointed attorney because I claimed poverty, which was true at the time. But there with my court-appointed attorney, I was urged to plead guilty to a lesser charge and accept some form of punishment. And I just recall that I went ahead and pled guilty to a lesser charge of, I think, following too closely or defective taillight. I can't remember exactly how it all went down, but at the end of the day, my license was suspended there in court, and it was a very sobering experience. I walked out of the courtroom, and I got in my car, and I drove home after the judge had just told me that I could not drive. Serious consequences, young man. We're going to suspend your license. You won't be able to drive anymore. And I drove myself home. Needless to say, it was not a good lesson for me as a young man because I didn't take the California justice system very seriously at that point. And so I commenced to get myself further and further into more trouble until eventually I had to flee the state under a cloud of suspicion. So anyway, let's have mercy on Thomas Hutchinson. If we really wanted to have mercy on him and teach him a valuable lesson, the lad should be caned in public there in the square in the north of England and really learn a lesson about justice before he ends up getting himself seriously hurt. And if he does so, this judge will bear some responsibility in this young man's continuing devolution toward chaos and anarchy. All right. More from the international file. From Paris, France, from the Reuters Wire, French police called off their search for a woman who had thrown herself in front of a speeding train when they found that she had dragged herself home and gone to bed. You know, the 58-year-old woman who suffered from depression jumped in front of a train as it sped through the station near Strasbourg. The train was moving at approximately 70 miles per hour when the woman threw herself onto the tracks in front of the train. And there was a search And there was some blood on the tracks, but the search was called off when the woman's partner, her partner, who was returning from a night shift at work, found her lying in bed with a broken arm and other injuries. Her partner, I said. Or I didn't say it. That's what Reuters said. It was her partner who came home, not her husband, notice. Now, we just don't know what's going on with the Reuters reporters and with political correctness in the Eurozone these days. Maybe they're not allowed to say wife anymore. Or maybe this was some depressed dyke who threw herself in front of a train. And anyway, I just don't know. It struck me as odd that it was her partner who arrived home after working a late shift. The woman, according to Reuters, who had attempted suicide in the past, there's another hint that she's probably a lesbian. The woman who had attempted suicide in the past was subsequently hospitalized. No current update on her condition, nor does anyone really care. But it's no wonder she was depressed. She obviously has a fear of commitment. I mean, she threw herself in front of the train, and then she backed out of the deal. She couldn't close the deal with the oncoming train at 70 miles an hour. A fairly interesting story, not all that entertaining. Could one posit the idea that God, in his mercy, saved this woman? Is it possible? God, in his infinite mercy, saved this woman. Well, you could say that. I mean, God didn't necessarily actively save this woman, but God wrote the laws of physics, and it's the laws of physics that dictate that in order for a train to move at 70 miles per hour on this particular configuration of track, there's a certain space needed between the wheels and a certain space needed between the axle and the ground or the train tracks. And so because of the laws of physics, this woman was apparently able to be run over by a train and was left relatively unscathed. So I guess we could say that God saved this woman. At least for the time being. We'll see what happens to her eternal soul. We'll find that out on Judgment Day. In fact, let's be sure to update this story on Judgment Day, and not a minute sooner. Thank you very much. All right, now let's move on through the international file to Khartoum in Sudan. Another story from the state-run media at Reuters News Service. A Sudanese woman facing 40 lashes for wearing trousers in public made her first appearance in a court packed with supporters this past Wednesday in what her lawyers described as a test case of Sudan's decency laws. Lubna Hussein is the young woman, Lubna, a former journalist who worked for the United Nations, attended the hearing wearing the same green slacks that had gotten her arrested for immodest dress. That's right. In certain portions of Sudan that are dominated by the Muslim governing officials there, for a woman to wear pants is considered immodest dress, for which a woman can be arrested, and then 40 lashes with a cane or a whip. Now, you may recall earlier, I talked about the young lad there in England who phoned in the bomb threat against Madison Square Garden, phoned the White House, and I posited the idea that he should be caned in public. So maybe you think I'm a savage on par with the Muslim leaders there in Sudan who want to cane this woman for wearing a pair of slacks. And I just want to separate myself from any implication that might indicate I am for caning women who wear pants. I am for caning young men who wear baggy pants and who wear their hats on crooked and have earrings and certain tattoos. But only if they do things worthy of caning, like phoning in a bomb threat. This young lady, I don't know, I didn't really see the pants, so I can't make a decision as to whether or not I think they are immodest, but either way, I think caning is a bit much in a case like this. Now, if she had a tramp stamp showing, then a caning could be in order. That's a good point made by my extremely attractive audio engineer. Let's see, now before the court hearing, the lady told Reuters that she was arrested in early July when police raided a party she was attending at a restaurant in Khartoum's Riyadh district. She says, quote, thousands of women are punished. She says, quote, thousands of women are punished with lashes in Sudan, but they stay silent. The law is being used to harass women, and I want to expose this, unquote. Now, I think that's probably an accurate depiction of the state of affairs in Sudan, since wherever Islam rules, for some reason they have to beat the women into submission. What's the deal there? I mean, if your religion produces a culture in which you have to literally beat the women into submission to keep them to keep them from just freaking out and rebelling and overturning your corrupt religious government. I mean, maybe you need to reassess your religion, okay? If you have to beat people into submission to follow your religion, well, I'm just saying maybe you should reassess it is all. Far be it from me to judge, though. Let's see. Scores of women, some wearing slacks and jeans, attended the case. So it isn't... You know, I really believe that Islam is the ultimate satanic religion. It is the culmination of 5,000 years of satanic religion, all wrapped up into what Satan would consider the ultimate religion for him to be the head of. I mean, it enslaves women. It keeps men in bondage under legalism. It fulminates constant escalating violence. And it ultimately destroys people's eternal souls in hell. Yeah. So I think that Islam is, I mean, Satan's been working for 5,000 years to create a religion through which he could subjugate the world and separate the world from the living God, the creator of the universe, and his son Jesus Christ. And it just appears to me that Islam is the culmination of that effort. Now, as far as women wearing pants, you know, I'm not sure where all that comes from. I think that Islamic men, for whatever reason, they seem to lack a certain self-confidence, and a certain they certainly lack self-control. And not that we in the West have any more self-control. I mean, for crying out loud, in the West, we just wish, like Madonna and Britney Spears and Paris, we just wish they'd put on some pants. You know? Stop grossing us out with that whole scene. Anyway, so Islam is, well, it's a serious matter. Let me put it that way. And we need to make some changes in order to let the Islamists know that we take Christianity seriously. And, well, getting a decent pair of pants on Madonna would at least be a start. I'm not saying it's going to make a whole bunch of difference in the big picture. But at least Entertainment Tonight would be less disgusting, okay? That's all I'm saying. Okay, let's move on into the politics file. Some domestic politics to begin with. From the Washington Times, a story on the Honorable Mr. Biden, Vice President Joe Biden. According to the Washington Times, the Obama White House's vaunted message machine has been thrown off track with increasing regularity by Vice President Joseph R. Plugs Biden, whose five verbal missteps in the past 3 months have created obstacles at home and abroad. Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton was forced this past Sunday to correct publicly Mr. Biden's characterization of Russia as a crumbling country, a description that infuriated Russian officials and contradicted President Obama's efforts to reset relations with Russia. This Sunday past, Mrs. Clinton made clear that the United States sees Russia as a great power. Russia is great. Yeah, that's what she said. After Biden, you know, during a visit to the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, said that Russia has, quote, a shrinking population base. And this is almost as if I was a prophet last week, okay? It's almost as if I was a prophet, because I warned Mr. Biden that when you operate and live in a universe of lies, it may be that when you utter the truth, you will be exposed among your peers as a fool. And, well, I mean, I'm not saying I'm a prophet. I'm just saying it's not that hard to peg Joe Biden to say something stupid. But Joe Biden, in this case, I mean, this is a true statement. Let's see what he said about Russia. He said they have a shrinking population base. They have a withering economy. They have a banking sector and structure that is not likely to be able to withstand the next 15 years. Now, there's a good chance that Joe Biden didn't make this up off the top of his plugs, off the top of his head. I mean, he's no genius, certainly no economist. He probably read this in a magazine on the way to wherever it was he made this statement. But either way, there are nuggets of truth in here that are like icebergs for the SS Biden as it tries to navigate through the waters of murky deception, misconception, and disinformation in which Mr. Biden exists. Now, we have a quote from Dimitri Symes, president of the Nixon Center. He says, you also see what's-his-name, a fellow pretending to be vice president, whose principal job, apparently, is to make his predecessor, Dick Cheney, look good. Well, come on now. I mean, that's a slam on Cheney. I mean, to compare Joe Biden to Dick Cheney, I mean, come on. There's not even a comparison there. I mean, that's just beyond the pale. I mean, Dick Cheney had the wherewithal to go bald gracefully. Never once did he have a single Botox injection, as far as we know. I don't think Dick Cheney ever partook of the botulinum toxin type A. And he certainly didn't embarrass his boss to the level that Joe Biden is capable of embarrassing President Barry Ho. And you know, the bottom line is, Dick Cheney is no Joe Biden.
Hello, hello, grandpa?
It's science!
And I am your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back to the second half of the Action Pack broadcast. As we continue to go worldwide to a worldwide audience, welcome aboard. Glad to have you in the audience. Sit back and relax. You don't have to do any of the heavy lifting. No need to smile and dial. No need to pick up the phone. We have it completely under control. We know what the news is. We know what we think about it. And we're going to tell you all about it. You just take it easy. Let's talk about Eric Holder. The Attorney General of the United States of America, as difficult as it is for me to say that without having to run to the toilet. Attorney General Eric Holder told ABC News in an exclusive interview that he is increasingly concerned about Americans becoming radicalized and turning to terrorism. Holder said the ever-changing threat of terror and the pressure to keep up with it weighs heavily on his mind as he tries to ensure that the government has done all it can to anticipate the moves of an unpredictable enemy. He had to clarify that he was not talking about Hillary Rodham Clinton, but he did clarify that. He says, in some ways, says Mr. Holder, in some ways it's the most sobering part of the day, referring to his morning intelligence briefings, in which he gets the latest report on the landscape from the organizations and the people who are bound and determined to do harm to our nation. I thought that was the Democratic prayer breakfast. Anyway, he says that's the most sobering part of his day, but we all know that he's not really actually sober, right? No way. I mean, so to speak. I mean, he's on the standard Obama administration cocktail of prescription medications, okay? So it's all above board. I mean, the doctor signed off on it all. But to assert that, for Mr. Holder to assert that he is sober at any time, strains credulity, to say the least. And this is all my opinion, of course. I don't know that Mr. Holder is on any particular prescription mind-altering chemicals. I mean, I don't know that. I wouldn't have access to that type of information. I simply am taking a look at the facts as they sit in front of me and making the best judgment I can for you, the audience, who don't have time to look into these matters. And, whatever that's good for. Let's see. What else does Mr. Holder have to say? Let's see. He says, quote, "The American people would be surprised by the depth of the threat, but also reassured to see the assets that have been deployed around the world to prevent terrorism," Mr. Holder is talking about. He added that the United States interacts closely with its foreign partners. That's very assuring to know that the bumbling, moronic children who have taken over the State Department, taken over the mechanisms of power, the U.S. military even, are interacting with our foreign partners. That really makes me feel good. I feel much better, Mr. Holder. Thank you very much. Now, please just get out. Please go back to Brooklyn or Oakland or wherever you're from. We're all cowards on race, according to Mr. Holder. I don't trust people like Eric Holder with the controls of power here in the United States. And I'm getting quite concerned for the future of the nation, frankly. I mean, Eric Holder, he's not qualified. He may be qualified to, let's see, Mr. Holder could be a librarian in a small Midwestern town. He could run a bicycle shop, perhaps, in Oakland. But Attorney General of the United States? I mean, am I in a bizarro world? Has the universe been taken and shaken up and stood on its head? You're telling me Eric Holder is the Attorney General of the United States? Please wake me up. Please tell me I'm dreaming. Tell me this is some horrible nightmare. But it's true, and we must face it, and we must soldier on together, my dear audience out there in podcast land. This is from the Justice File. We'll move out of the politics file for a moment into the Justice File. Dateline San Jose, California. Prosecutors will not seek the death penalty in the case of a Silicon Valley engineer charged with fatally shooting three people at a Santa Clara high-tech firm. Maybe you all remember this crime. It happened in November of 2008. Zhang Hua Wu shot three executives at the company from which he had just been laid off. And he would have been eligible for the death penalty, according to the Associated Press, if convicted of the first-degree murder charges and the special circumstances that were filed against him after he had gunned down the three executives involved in his unfortunate layoff. But Santa Clara County District Attorney Dolores...
District Attorney Dolores in Santa Clara County.
Dolores Carr announced this past Thursday that her office determined that a life in prison without parole sentence would be an appropriate sentence for Wu, if he is convicted, on the off chance that he's actually convicted in this completely bizarro justice system out in Santa Clara County. Her office determined that life in prison was appropriate. By the way, prosecutors say that Wu shot the three executives after he was fired from the company. So what gives Santa Clara County District Attorney Dolores the right to determine that life in prison is appropriate for a man who, in cold blood, gunned down three men in broad daylight in front of God and everybody? Everybody knows he did it. He's guilty of it. What gave her the right to decide that a death sentence was not appropriate? Well, she gave herself the right, because she is apparently a law unto herself.
District Attorney Dolores in Santa Clara County, welcome to court. How may I help you this morning?
Warning, 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 Will Robertson, there are Bible verses up ahead. For those in the audience who advocate pluralism and diversity, we know here at the Weekly Worldview that you would not tolerate anyone who would ever dare quote a Bible verse in public, so this warning gives you fair notice that raw, unadulterated truth is about to be uttered. Take me, my brother, to Ezekiel, the 13th chapter, and the 19th verse. And will you profane me among my people, killing people who should not die, and keeping people alive who should not live? That's the creator of the universe, that's the living God, who will judge District Attorney Dolores on Judgment Day. He says, will you profane me, Dolores, by keeping people alive who should not live? And Dolores says, yes, I will. I will profane you. Welcome to court. Excuse me, what did you say? It's Judgment Day? Oh, I would like to request an attorney. Oh, what do you mean there will be no attorneys on Judgment Day? did you get the most recent memo from my office?
No, we didn't see the memo, Dolores. All right, let's move on into the war file, a story that has gotten very little coverage, and that's very disturbing to me. Dateline Little Rock, Arkansas, a 23-year-old man has pleaded not guilty to charges that he shot and killed a soldier outside an Arkansas Army recruiting center, and prosecutors say they will seek the death penalty. Abdul Hakim Mohammed is accused of fatally shooting Private William Andrew Long and wounding another soldier back on June 1st. You all remember the story, right? Muslim with rifle shoots two Army personnel in front of a recruiting office in Little Rock, Arkansas. Sounds like domestic terrorism to me. But no. No, it's simply, it's just an incident. We don't know. Just because he's a Muslim doesn't mean we need to draw the conclusion that he shot these men for any kind of political reason. Certainly don't want to jump to any conclusions. Now, a Pulaski County judge, according to the Associated Press, has set a trial date of February 15th of next year in this case. And Muhammad's lawyer said that his client is in good spirits, but wouldn't say whether Muhammad's calls to the media claiming responsibility for the murder would affect his case. So his lawyer says, well, you know, there is the fact that my client called the media and claimed responsibility for the shootings. I'm not sure how that's going to affect his case. But I'll get back to you on that. After all, this is America. You can call ABC and go live on TV worldwide and announce that you did it, and we would still put you through a 1 or 2 year trial process before more than likely sentencing you to life, not executing you as we should. It's just ridiculous. Mohammed, according to the Associated Press, not according to the Associated Press, he called the Associated Press twice to discuss the shootings. In those conversations, Muhammad says he doesn't consider the killing murder because U.S. military action in the Middle East justifies it. Oh, yeah, this isn't related to the war on terror. Not in any way. How could one think that? It's bizarre. These days, even a confession won't necessarily secure a conviction in today's system. All right. Let's see here. Now let's go to Havana, Cuba. From the Reuters Wire, let's see here. I don't know if I can pronounce this person's name. Benicio del Toro, Bill Murray, and Robert Duvall and James Caan visited Cuba last week with Mr. Benicio, or is it Mrs.? I really don't know who this person is. Benicio, is that a boy's name or a girl's name? Benicio sounds like Ben. Let's assume it's a boy, but I have no clue. Del Toro was in town there in Havana to pick up an award, and the other three, Bill Murray, Robert Duvall, and James Caan, were apparently working on a, quote, research project, unquote, as they visited Havana, Cuba. Now, you all know that there's a long-standing trade embargo against communist Cuba. Americans have been forbidden from visiting the island, generally speaking. But Hollywood stars such as Robert Redford, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and director Steven Spielberg have come to Cuba in the past, but cultural exchange is slow due to restrictions imposed by former U.S. President George W. Bush. So, Barry Ho and the boys and girls in his kindergarten class, who are now running the Western world, have decided to soften and thaw relations with Cuba. And so, yeah, according to the story here, Reuters, U.S. President Barry Ho, Barack Obama, offered earlier this year to recast relations with Cuba. So he sends these guys down. Murray, Robert Duvall, James Caan, I guess he sent them all down because they're almost the same age as Castro, and they can all kind of relate to the same kind of stories. I don't know what the deal is there. The interesting part of this story, and I know you've been following it and you're wondering, what is the interesting part of this story, Doug? Could you please get to the point? Last week, the United States set a Bush-era news ticker on the U.S. Interest Section building in Havana, which the Cuban government viewed as an affront, had been turned off. Now, have you ever been to New York City? And outside the NBC studios, there's the big black ticker. And across it go the headlines for the news of the day. Well, Bush had one installed right there where all the Cubans could look at it. News from the World Wire Services, unrestricted by the Cuban government, right there for Cuban citizens to see. So they could see how civilization is basically passing them by as they sit there in their rusted out Volkswagens. Well, Barry Ho turned it off because... Well, I'm not sure why. I guess the State Department has determined that the Cuban people have no need for news from the outside world. I guess they made that determination. I guess that the U.S. State Department has determined that the Cuban people have no need for news from the outside world. No, they don't need that. You know. And with the state of the media these days, they're... They probably realized that running news from the modern midstream media wires was redundant in that it's virtually indistinguishable from whatever news service Castro supports down there. I'm Doug McBurney. We're rounding third and headed for home this week's broadcast, and we're going to get into the domestic tranquility file. I have to move through it quickly. The first story is really about the evolution of a headline, but the story itself is frightening. This is from earlier in the week. I grabbed this headline from Worcester, Massachusetts, from the Associated Press. The headline reads, "Massachusetts woman killed, fetus removed from womb." A pregnant woman was found dead in her apartment with her fetus cut from her womb. The police were looking for the missing baby, which they said could have survived. The woman, 23-year-old Darlene Haynes, her body was found last Monday by her landlord. This was the first article I saw on this story, and I pulled it down, and what bothered me the most at that time was that, according to the Associated Press, they interviewed some neighbors. Neighbors said that they could often hear a lot of fighting and screaming from the woman's apartment. One neighbor said, quote, "We used to hear her crying and screaming, but no one ever really did anything," she said, adding that neighbors did not want to get involved. That just bothered me. I mean, if you hear screaming and crying and weeping from an apartment on a regular basis, I mean, this just reminds me of that old story of Cain, when God came to him and said, "What have you done to your brother?" And Cain said, "Hey, am I my brother's keeper?" And that's kind of what the neighbors sound like to me here. Yeah, she was screaming, crying, weeping, I don't know, glass was breaking, but hey, am I my neighbor's keeper? I mean, it's no wonder we've got neo-Nimrodians running the country. We've got neo-Canaanites? No, what would you call them? I don't know what you'd call them. I mean, it's basically the descendants of Cain. We're witnessing the descent of Cain throughout human culture. And to speak of that attitude in the media, initially I didn't really notice that they called it a fetus. It didn't really click with me. Because I'm so used to reading left-wing bilge from the left-wing media wires that they slipped some things past the goalie once in a while, okay? I can't catch everything. But the folks over at American Right to Life wrote a very compelling article on this story in WorldNet Daily. Go there, search Brian Rohrbaugh, he wrote the story, and he points out that while it was indeterminate that the child was alive, when it was quite possible that the child had been murdered, The news media in headlines across the country called it a fetus. But I have an update from later in the week. After the child was found, the headline says that it was a baby cut from the womb. Yeah. And it's you got to read Rohrbaugh's article. That's all. I'm not going to say any more about that. Go to WorldNet Daily and check it out. It's definitely worth a read. Anyway, to update on the story, now the woman was found dead. Her child was taken from her womb. And the update from Worcester, Mass. Later in the week, the boyfriend of the Massachusetts woman accused of kidnapping a baby girl who had been cut from the slain mother's womb said that he was convinced he was the infant's father and was stunned when police moved in on the couple. The woman called up her boyfriend and said, "I just went into labor and had a baby." And he believed it. He called his parents, he called his family, announced that him and his slut girlfriend, who he'd been shacking up with on and off for the past couple of years, had had a baby, miracle of all miracles. And in reality, she was a murderer who had killed a woman and taken the child from her womb. Just a disturbing story. At last report, the baby was in good health and is in custody of the Massachusetts Department of Children and Families. So it's in good health for the moment, but it's been taken by the state of Massachusetts. So the state of the child's eternal soul is definitely in question. The fate of the child's soul. Someone needs to rescue that child from the state of Massachusetts. All right. On into the domestic tranquility file. Dateline, Indianapolis, Indiana, from the Indianapolis Star. 2-year-old girl was in critical condition this past week after being one of 3 people shot Saturday night at a wedding reception in Lawrence Community Park, Indiana. The child, Yuridia Sosa, at last report, was in critical condition at Methodist Hospital. Francisco Ponce, a 21-year-old Indianapolis youth, was arrested at the scene for attempted murder. That's a wedding reception in the heartland. Dateline San Antonio, Texas. A woman charged with murdering her 3.5-year-old son used a knife and 2 swords to dismember the child and 8 parts of his body, including his brain, before stabbing herself in the torso and slicing her own throat. This is the state of domestic tranquility in San Antonio, Texas. Ati Sanchez, a 33-year-old mom, was charged with capital murder and the death of her infant son, Scott Wesley Buchholz Sanchez. She was recovering from her wounds at a hospital and is being held on $1 million bail. San Antonio Police Chief William McManus said the early Sunday morning attack occurred a week after the child's father moved out of the house. I'm not going to go into the details because they're just too disturbing. Police said Sanchez claims the devil told her to kill her son. It was the devil. Okay. Dateline Wheaton, Illinois, from the Associated Press. It's from the Injustice file. A convicted murderer pleaded guilty Tuesday to the 1983 slaying of a 10-year-old girl in a case that had helped lead to landmark reforms in Illinois after 2 other men endured multiple trials, death sentences, and more than 10 years in prison before being cleared. Brian Duggan admitted to murdering Janine Nisarico, 26 years ago. Now, the case, you may not remember, but the case at the time, officials there in Illinois said that the case shined a light on a flawed capital punishment system after the two men were cleared, as evidence increasingly pointed to Duggan. Several law enforcement officials went on trial for their handling of the case, and all were acquitted. And then, you'll remember, Governor George Ryan of Illinois cited the case of one of several that led to his decision to stop all Illinois executions back in 2000. The death penalty moratorium put in place by Ryan remains in place, though death sentences may still be issued, according to the Associated Press. Yeah, there is no moratorium on the death penalty in Illinois, by the way. Governor Ryan may think that he put a moratorium on the death penalty, but there is no moratorium. It's just that the guilty aren't the only ones being killed in mass numbers in Illinois anymore. Yeah, that's right. The death penalty has been transferred now to the innocent citizens of the state of Illinois, and it's happening more and more on a regular basis. Many, according to this article, I don't really care about this article anymore. You know what? It just makes me sick. It makes me sick that because a justice system that's overwhelmed with an epidemic of bloodshed and violent crime bungles a case, and because of that, former Governor George Ryan, a commie red piece of garbage, filth, humanist scum, ends all capital punishment in Illinois. Sickening and disgusting. Okay, and let's talk about the fruit of Mr. Ryan's labors. Dateline, Chicago, Illinois. 7 people were shot late Tuesday on the city's west side in one of numerous overnight shootings that left more than a dozen people wounded. At least 15 people were shot and wounded in Chicago overnight last Tuesday into Wednesday, 7 of them in a single incident. So 15 people in a matter of a few hours on the south side of Chicago, on the west side of Chicago, are slaughtered. And Governor Ryan claims that there is no death penalty in Illinois anymore. Has he walked the streets of Chicago lately? Mr. Ryan, there is a death penalty in Chicago. You've simply inflicted it on the innocent citizens. Thank you very much. I'm taking a note. I will see you on Judgment Day. Okay. More from the Domestic Tranquility File. Can we do any more from the Domestic Tranquility File? No, we really can't. We really can't because there's just too much. Baltimore. 17 people were shot and 2 killed in separate incidents this past Sunday night over a stretch of about 3 hours on the east side of Baltimore. All right. No more from the Domestic Tranquility File because I just can't take it anymore. Dateline, New York City. New York City is buying one-way plane tickets for homeless families to leave the city. That's right. It's part of Mayor Michael Bloomberg's program to keep the homeless out of the expensive shelter system. More than 550 families have left the Big Apple since 2007. All it takes is for a relative to agree to take them in. City officials say none of the relocated families have returned to city shelters, as far as they know. And they're probably not checking too hard. Anyway, just embarrassing. What's a liberal to do? You promote homelessness, you're overrun by homelessness, you realize you can't afford it, you try to send them off to Alabama or something. Try to let them deal with it, for crying out loud. All right, let's see. What other stories do we want to do here? Oh, from Port Chester, New York. The high school there is providing high school students a needed service. A recent decision by the Port Arthur Board of Education says that, officials have signed off on a new service that will offer free testing for sexually transmitted diseases and even pregnancy testing to any student who asks, and the parents need not be told about it. Yes. Let's see here. We have a quote from Superintendent Donald Carlisle, candidate for one of the hottest parts in hell. He says, like any other school, we have teen pregnancy. So when a young lady comes down, we offer a test and guide her and refer her from that point on. So they refer her to someone. I doubt they refer her to an OBGYN. They probably refer her to an abortion clinic. But that's just my opinion. I don't really know. All right, let's end it here, okay? Let's end it mercifully here. Dateline Clearwater, Florida. An Atlantic bottlenose dolphin was attacked by sharks and had to be euthanized just hours after he was released into the Gulf of Mexico. The juvenile male dolphin was released after 8 months in rehab recovering from pneumonia, was attacked by at least 2 sharks. Experts rushed to the dolphin and euthanized him because the life-threatening injuries. Officials said that the dolphin would not have been able to recover. Don't cry. No, but think about it. This reminds me, it's like dropping off a kid at the public schools. I mean, for crying out loud. The injuries could be something from which they may never recover. So think about that. All right. Thank you for being with us this week, folks. We will be back next week. Until then, I want to thank my friends at American Right to Life, KGov Radio, Denver Bible Church, the Brethren at Personhood USA, and all my fellow talkers over at Theology Online, and of course my other brother Daryl, who makes it all happen here at the Weekly Worldview Studios. I'll be back with you next week. Until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.